Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, everyone. This is Jeanette Wallace-Gadge here today bringing you Cobblestones Chronicles. And it's my pleasure to be with you on such a damp day. We've had some nice weather, but here we go, a little bit of a damp day, and it's probably a good thing to have some rain. I've got a real treat in store this morning, or this afternoon rather, because I was chatting with a friend of mine who is a retired radio journalist. You might know, I've heard him, because he did Country File for many years. His name is Kevin Eichen. And he mentioned to me that in the early to mid-1990s, he'd done some recording in Greytown of Frank Fife. Now, Frank Fife was a well-known character. He published a newspaper, and I have been told that occasionally he would write letters to the editor himself on fairly controversial topics, and then respond to them, so to make it interesting. And one of his loves was collecting stories and collecting songs, because he was an active member of the folk music community in New Zealand. And along with Phil Garland, they collected a lot of old New Zealand songs. So although people say, oh, well, you know, there's not much tradition in New Zealand and not many old songs, there's actually quite a few. So Frank Fife collected them, and when he could, recorded them and made sure that they were kept for posterity. And Kevin had done some interviews with him. And one of the things that Frank did was he collected stories, old stories of the Wairarapa, and he printed them. And if you're watching on TV, I'm holding up one of the little booklets that he printed now. He had a printing business in Wakeland House in Main Street, Greytown. And these books are actually, some of them are in the libraries. So if you want to have a read of the books, you can go to any of the libraries and ask for them. I don't think you're allowed to take them out of the library. They're just reference books now. But once I've done this, I will be handing these into the libraries, because I reckon they're really good. So this morning I thought I might play to you the interview where Kevin talks to Frank Fife about this story, Carterton's Naked Geese, a tale from pioneering days. And it's probably has some elements of truth in it, because of course it's a story, it's a tale, but I just thought you might quite enjoy it. So here we go, the story of Carterton's Naked Geese.
This is a story, obviously a story. One feels a bloody idiot saying that this is a story. This is a story from the earliest days of Wairarapa. It concerns, among other things, the first house cow in the town of Carterton. A lot of people will know that Wairarapa is dotted with small towns. There's four that are approximately 7 miles apart, which in those days, in the early 50s, 1850s, was considered to be a reasonable distance to travel, 7 miles. The site of Featherston, of course, is logical as an entry point to the valley, and was actually identified as a site for a township very early in the 1840s, 1841-42. But it wasn't until 1853 that finally the land was bought. The Ngāti Kahununu refused to sell land in the Wairarapa until no less a personage than the governor himself, George Grey, came over and passed over the gold. And so it was in August 1853 that he interrupted his trip back to England. He was leaving New Zealand to spend a week in South Wairarapa and buy the land. It was on this land that the Small Farm Association, originally called the Working Men's Land Association, was to establish New Zealand's first inland planned settlement. And that got underway in March 1854 when the first settlers came to Greytown. So Greytown's the first inland town in New Zealand. It was established on Thursday, the 27th of March 1854. And just 6 weeks later, the second inland town was established at Masterton. Now, Dr. Featherston, who was the Wellington Provincial Superintendent, was actually not a Grey fan. He was not a liberal. He represented the squatter interest, the landholder interest. And he felt that the Wellington Provincial Council was missing out on land sales. And so in 1857, just 3 years after the town of Greytown and Masterton were established, just 3 years later, he set up an auction sale to auction sections in Featherston, and then later in the same year set up a town between Masterton and Greytown in what was then the 4 Mile Bush, which later became Carterton. So this story is to do with those first three formative years in the Carterton settlement. The idea was to import workers, migrant labour. They had to repay the provincial council the passage money and the money for 10 acres of land, and they had to clear the land from bush, had to build their own houses, fences, and they were to work on the road, the Great Northeastern Dray Road, now State Highway 2. And they were to cut that through the 4 Mile Bush to connect the small farm settlements of Greytown and Masterton. All worked out very well in theory until 1859, just 2 years later, when Featherston was denied supply in the Wellington Provincial Council. The Wakefield majority refused to vote him funds for the public works program. So, of course, all public works came to a halt. The Carterton workers were laid off, and they still had to pay money to the Provincial Council. They still had to repay their passage money and their land purchase money, and they had to live. The winter of 1859 saw about half the township leave for pastures greener. Those that remained suffered terribly in the winter of 1859. There was no money coming in. They were settled on very, very rough bush sections. They had enough firewood, but they had very little to eat. In fact, the closest shops were in Greytown, 7 miles away, and the shopkeepers were charging outrageous prices for foodstuffs. And people did absolutely all sorts of things to exist, to survive. One of the things that one family, we'll call them the Joneses, did was to open up their front room as a pub. Unlicensed, completely illegal, but they just opened it up as a pub. The menfolk, the Jones menfolk, were away working on the roads or working for surrounding landholders or whatever they could to get wages. And the womenfolk, there was Mary Jones, the eldest, and the two daughters-in-law, ran the house as a pub. They homebrewed, and it was quite a good drop. It became widely renowned. Travellers spoke of the quality of their home-brewed ale from the Jones pub. And more than that, they spoke of the quality of the food. And the Jones ladies were very, very good cooks, and they had vegetable gardens, and that supplied most of their table needs. And from the proceeds over the winter of 1859 from their homebrew sales and so forth, they saved up and purchased the first house cow into the township of Carterton. Hazel was her name, and Hazel was a godsend. Hazel supplied milk, of course, and cream. The cream could be made into butter and could be made into cheese, and it could be whipped up into delightful dessert toppings for fresh strawberries just pulled out of the garden. Well, travellers appreciated this, and the Jones ladies appreciated Hazel the house cow. Now, Hazel was in the habit of replying to Mary Jones. Mary Jones would come down in the early morning and open the front door and call out, "Hazel, Hazel," and moo would come the answering call from Hazel the house cow. This particular morning, Mary Jones came down early to milk the cow. "Hazel, Hazel," she called out, and there was no answering moo. Mary went over to the house paddock fence, and she looked south and she looked north. She could not see a sign of Hazel. She called again, "Hazel, Hazel." No answering moo. And then she spotted poor old Hazel the house cow had eaten tutu and died. Well, that was a calamity, because the money that Hazel the house cow earned through lashings of whipped cream and through the butter was what was keeping the Jones family on their section. It was an economic disaster, because you couldn't even eat the meat from an animal that died of tutu poisoning. Well, what were they to do? The three ladies had a little conference, and they decided that there was nothing they could do about poor old Hazel except bury her. And three ladies on their own could hardly manage that. So they decided that they would offer the first traveller through all day drinking, as much as he could drink, if he would bury Hazel the house cow. And it so happened that the very first traveller through was no less a personage than the local sexton, who willingly agreed. He was quite a good man on the old drink, of Irish extraction, and he decided that he would need, his digging muscles would need limbering up. And so he fronted the bar, and he said, "Could I have part of me wages before I actually start me digging?" Well, the Jones ladies agreed, and he stood there for an hour, breasting the bar, and quaffing quantities of the Jones homebrew ale. And then he went out to bury Hazel the house cow. The Jones ladies at lunchtime went out to see how he was getting on, and he had the hole dug, but the cow wasn't quite buried. "You'll stay for lunch, of course," said Mary Jones. "Well, yes, as so happens, I would like to stay for lunch. Have you got lashings of whipped cream on your strawberries?" "Yes," said Mary Jones, "but unfortunately, with Hazel gone, this will be the last." "Oh, that's a terrible shame, terrible shame." Well, sure enough, lunch, and our sexton friend had buried the cow and returned to the bar a few drinks before lunch. Lunch, of course, was a great success. Jones ladies were congratulating themselves on having got rid of this rather large body. What they couldn't get rid of was the sexton, who was still breasting the bar. Finally, around about afternoon tea time, "And yes, thanks, I will have a scone with jam and lashings of whipped cream." Finally, after afternoon tea, the sexton decided that he would leave. He went to the front door, opened the front door and out into the yard and closed the door. The Jones ladies looked at each other and they breathed a sigh of relief. But the sexton had hardly closed the door behind him than he was back. Breasting the bar, he said, "Quick, give me something to steady me nerves." "What happened?" said the Jones ladies. "Well, you know how your cow had eaten the toot and died?" "Yes," said the Jones ladies. "You know your flock of geese?" "Yes," said the Jones ladies. "Well, they're all lying out there on the yard, stone dead." Well, this was another calamity. Jones ladies rushed outside, and sure enough, where Hazel the house cow had forced the fence into the bush, so too the geese had got through, and they assumed, and there they were, lying dead around the house paddock. Well, this was another calamity. Mary Jones responded by saying to our friend the sexton, 12 burials. Could you manage 12 burials for, shall we say, another dozen glasses?"
"Oh, yes, I think I could manage."
And so that's exactly where the situation was. There was, however, some economic return from geese. You couldn't eat the flesh from the animals who died of tutu poisoning, but you could make eiderdowns out of the chest down feathers, and you could stuff mattresses with the other feathers. And so the lady set to with a will to pluck the 12 geese. They plucked the geese and tossed them in a heap out in the yard, while our friend the sexton consumed his last dozen glasses. And finally he'd consumed the last and headed for the door. A trifle unsteadily, but he headed for the door. And he opened the door and he went through and he closed the door. And the Jones-sized ladies breathed another sigh of relief. But once again, the sexton was hardly gone than he was back.
"Oh, sure, you'll have to give me something more. You know your geese."
"Yes," said the Jones ladies.
"Well, they're not dead at all. They're struggling around your yard, naked as the day they was born."
The Jones ladies went to the door, and sure enough, that's exactly what they saw. 12 geese staggering around naked in the house paddock. What had happened, of course, the geese hadn't eaten the tutu. The Jones ladies were in the habit of tossing the hops from their home brew into a pile over into the bush. The geese had got through and made a meal of it, and they were dead all right, dead drunk. Well, resourceful pioneer ladies responded in the way resourceful pioneer ladies have always responded. They decided that the only proper thing to do was to clothe the naked geese. And so they had a working party and they knitted 12 little jackets. Those 12 jackets were what kept the geese warm until some new feathers grew just before Christmas and just in time to get them onto the Christmas dinner tables of Carterton. And there the story would have ended, except that word spread beyond Carterton, beyond Masterton, up into the 40-mile bush. And travellers from far and near came by the Jones Hostel to see the sight of 12 geese wandering around in little knitted jackets. And business at the Jones household went very well indeed, so much so that by the end of the summer of 1860, they were able to buy a replacement for Hazel the house cow.
And that was the tale of the naked geese. And of course, it involved the house cow. And many of our farming families would have had a house cow in the 1850s through to, well into the 20th century. And you kept it in the backyard and there it was, fresh milk on tap. And I love the idea of the naked geese with their little jackets on, because after all, it wouldn't be very comfortable being naked. A very amusing tale. And I've got more to come from next show. So, things that are happening at Cobblestones at the moment. Oh, yes, we are planning for Carols at Cobblestones. Carols at Cobblestones is a great tradition. It's just lovely. And this year it's on Saturday, the 14th of December. There'll be some lovely entertainment, an opportunity to sing your heart out with traditional Christmas carols and perhaps some not so traditional Christmas carols. Always a lovely, lovely evening. And there'll be food for sale, so lots of food that you can buy. So just come along and have a really good Christmassy, great way to start Christmas. What else is happening? Oh, yes, we're planning to open Cobblestones and have some family-friendly activities on New Year's Day. Because, as you all know, New Year's Day, everything else is closed, or most other things are closed. So come along to Cobblestones, have some fun, bring a picnic, you know, enjoy sitting in the grounds and having a picnic and letting the kids run around and work off some steam. So that's the 1st of January 2025. Gosh, it's amazing thinking about 2025 already, and it's really not that long away, because we're now well into January, into November. See, I'm going mad. I'm thinking about January already. So that's what's happening at Cobblestones. The build of the new building, which is going to house the horse-drawn carriages and some of the engines that we have at Cobblestones, is going really well. It's starting to look like, you know, there is a building there, and we are still looking to raise funds, and we are going to be, whenever we have something like Carols at Cobblestones, all the proceeds do go into the buildings and maintenance of everything at Cobblestones. The fit out is the next stage, and the team have already been talking about the fit out, which is exciting. And the we have a professional museum exhibit designer going to come and do the fit out so that it's done professionally and properly. Now, what else is going on? Well, you know, we have a few visits planned from various places. We get lots of people visiting Cobblestones in groups. So we have, for example, some school groups who come down, and we have a lot of fun with them, because some of us volunteers go in and do things like pretend that we're the school teacher in the school, or we help, you know, walk around with people explaining to them what was what in the day. And we let the kids have lunch outside in the grounds, or they can use our administration room. So we have a large meeting room, and they can use that, so if it's raining. So that works out quite well. We also have groups from retirement villages and our rest homes, and they come down or up to Cobblestones and thoroughly enjoy it, because, of course, they remember much of the older things in there. So that's always fun to do that. And Cobblestone's Friends of Cobblestone's team can always put on morning tea, afternoon tea, or a jolly night's lunch for a reasonable cost. And again, all the profits from that go to Cobblestone's Museum. Right, now, how about we have a tune? And I was thinking over the weekend what I might like to play you. And I thought I'd play this one. It's Robert Burns' poem set to music, because he used old tunes. He didn't write music himself, but what he did was he used old tunes to produce his songs. And this one is Scots Wahee. And you'll notice that it talks about Wallace. And Wallace was my ancestor, we believe. Not directly, because he was had his head chopped off and he was hung, drawn and quartered before he had any children. But it still, we think it possibly could have been ours. But anyway, here we go. Here is Scots Wahee by Robbie Burns.
Scots Wahee, you all is bled. Scots Wambrus has often led. Welcome to Gory Ben, oh, victory. Knows the day and knows the hour. See the front battle hour, see approach, proud Edward's power, chains and slavery. War will be a traitor knave, war can fill coward's grave. War say base, be slave, let him turn and flee. War for Scotland's king and lord, freedom sought will strongly draw. Free man stand, a free man falls, let him on with me. Let us do our day.
with Wallace bled. Scots won Bruce as often led. Welcome to your gory bed, or to victory. Now's the day, and now's the hour. See the front, battle hour. See, approach, proud Edward's power. Chains and slavery.
Scots were he, and talking a Robbie Burns poem about freedom and standing up for your rights. Of course, it wasn't actually that long after the Jacobite Rebellion that Rabie was born, and Scotland would still have been feeling the effects of the clampdown on various freedoms, including things like wearing the kilt. Yep, wasn't wearing the tartan wasn't allowed for a while. And what was even more insidious is that the people who had been on the English side, because it wasn't not all Scots actually wanted James or Bonnie Prince Charlie back. It was mostly the Highlanders who wanted the Stuart clan back in power. So I'll play you another song later called You Jacobites by Name, which is kind of taking a mickey out of the Jacobites. But there is a story that in toasts in the 19th century, early 19th century, when the king was being toasted, if you were a Jacobite, you would actually pass your glass of wine over a glass of water, because then you were toasting the king over the water. So there, that's some useless, trivial information these days. Now, I was going to read you a bit about laundry, because one of the exciting things in pioneering days and previous times was getting the laundry done, of course. I mean, it was often big families and the laundry still had to be done. But I have here this wonderful book that I found, Inside Stories, A History of the New Zealand Housewife from 1890 to 1975. And I just think the discussions about getting the laundry done are wonderful. There's in the 1920s, the New Zealand Woman and Home recommended placing a piece of pipe clay in the copper to give clothes a beautiful colour. I don't quite know why, but anyway. A lady called Pat shared her technique for dealing with elusive soap in 1932. I always thread my cake of soap with a piece of white elastic about 3/4 yard long and fasten it on the tap. Tie a knot at one end or sew on a small button. The elastic gives and the soap is never jerked out of your hands if you happen to be soaping a large article. In 1934, the New Zealand Home Journal told housewives to wear an old pair of fabric or chamois leather gloves when washing. This tip also means an economy of soap, for a certain amount remains in the glove fabric. Home and Country, the Women's Institute magazine, forever on the alert for prodigal behaviour, urged housewives in 1940 to save their starch and use it for washing tiled floors for a glossy result. And as late as 1973, Ellen suggested that before heading for the washing line, housewives put the telephone in an inverted baking tin so as to not miss a call. I'm not too sure why that works. I suppose it would make it very loud. We don't know we're born, do we? We just take our telephones with us all the time these days. Equipment maintenance was also thoroughly covered in household hints pages. For example, boil wooden pegs once a month. They last longer if you do that. Steep a new rope clothesline first in boiling water, then in cold. It won't sag and it won't mark the clothes then. Oil the wringer with pure glycerine. Oil will mark the washing. Glycerine obviously won't. It just make it nice and sticky. My husband tells a story of one of his brothers. The two of them were playing about with the wringer and one of them actually managed to get his hand caught in the wringer and right up to the elbow. I think that might have been just a bit painful. It also says add ammonia to the subs. Sutton, add ammonia to the suds after a wash in a copper. Makes it easier to remove the hard curd soap from the sides of the copper when it's dry. Gosh, I don't know about this at all. There's also a wonderful picture of a basket being lowered into a copper, which of course was the way that clothes were washed in those days. And this is probably, this looks like maybe just pre-Second World War. So I know my great aunt still washed her clothes and sheets and everything in a copper when she lived out in the country in Perthshire, and I used to go and visit her, and I would be helpful by stirring the copper, and it had a fire underneath it to keep everything, keep the water hot. It was very exciting. And then I would be sent out into the garden to weed between the rows of peas and beans and things. And if I was the one weeding between the rows, you'd be jolly lucky if there were any peas left, because I used to pick them and eat them straight off the plant. And beans as well. I love raw beans and raw peas still. It was interesting, this is still from this book about secrets of domestic goddesses in the early 20th century. Sometimes the collective wisdom of housewives could even take an expert's breath away. In 1969, Home and Country reported that Miss Antcliffe of the New Zealand Wool Board had dropped in on the Opotiki Women's Institute, telling their members that she had heard the town was a place where the women really knew how to wash blankets. Miss Antcliffe's predecessor had told her that when she had visited the Bay of Plenty town shortly after a flood in 1964, it was to find women soaking their silted up blankets in cold water before washing them, which had made them even whiter and softer than they had been in their antediluvian state. So there you go, if you get flooded out and you need to wash your blankets, you need to put them in cold water first. I didn't know that. clever laundresses knew that technique, and washing agents could only get them so far if the local water supply wasn't up to snuff, though. In 1973, writing in New Zealand Woman and Stitch, R.J. Smithies, the director of the Consumers Institute, suggested ways to counter the effects of hard water, a condition which is caused by too much calcium and magnesium in the water, which, when combined with soap, followed insoluble scum that stuck to the clothes. That was a problem. Napier, Hastings and Whanganui were afflicted with the problem, so it must be a band that goes through that area. Dunedin was free from it, and ringers were best for housewives in northern cities, wrote Smith. In a ringer machine, the water is squeezed out and travels over the surface of the fabric, flushing the soap scum away. But in washers where the wash and rinse waters are removed by spinning, the clothes can act as a filter to stop the scum forming. Goodness me. It's so different from just flinging a bundle of towels and things into the washing machine, or even just dashing over in between songs I play on here. You might dash over and see what's happening in the washing machine. Okay, so why don't we have another song now? I think I'll play You Jacobites by Name, which is a kind of taking the mickey a little bit out of the existing Jacobites. So I just need to dial it up on this. There we go. And here we have You Jacobites by Name.
Jacobites by name, lend an ear, lend an ear. Ye Jacobites by name, lend an ear. Ye Jacobites by name, your faults I will proclaim, your doctrines I must blame. You shall hear, you shall hear, your doctrines I must blame, ye shall hear. What is right and what is wrong, by the law, by the law. What is right and what is wrong, by the law. What is right and what is wrong, a short sword or a long, a weak arm or a strong, for to draw, a weak arm or a strong, for to draw. What makes heroic strife? Famed afar, famed afar. What makes heroic strife? Famed afar. What makes heroic strife? To whet the assassin's knife, or haunt a parent's life with bloody war, bloody war, or haunt a parent's life with bloody war. Then let your schemes alone, in the state, then let your schemes alone in the state. I let your schemes alone, adore the rising sun, and leave a man alone to his fate, to his fate, and leave a man alone to his fate.
That was You Jacobites by Name with a lovely little additional tune. That was Lynn Wilkie, who was singing. Lynn Wilkins is a well-known New Zealand singer, and she also writes her own songs. She plays guitar and she plays flute beautifully, often accompanied by her partner, Michael McKinnon, who's particularly proud of his Scottish heritage. And I recommend, if they come to anywhere near you, I recommend going and seeing them and listening to them, because they're really good. They're absolutely great. Okay, well, it's almost time for me to finish up. I just want to say I hope you enjoyed the programme today. I will be playing another of the stories recorded by Kevin Aiken of Frank Fife telling his stories. I'm also going to lodge these with Wairarapa Archives so that they're held in safety for the future. I think it's really important that that happens. Okay, so take care of each other, be kind to each other, and look after each other the way the early pioneers did, and the people who were here already, the Māori, Iwi, who were very kind in the Wairarapa and worked very well with the European settlers. In fact, it was often, Greytown was known as the Twin Towns, because Papawai Marae and Greytown were well known for the people working together, which is really delightful, and hopefully we can keep on celebrating that. Lovely, well, have a wonderful day, and I'll be back again soon. Bye for now. Kia ora.